This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for limited time and subject to change. Max one offer per account.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Decade Project. This is the One Heat Minute Productions Patreon podcast where we look back at the film's 10 or 11 years in the rear view. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Today, this is a very special episode. It's an episode that is leaping out of our Patreon and jumping straight to our main feed. And why it is doing that is because this is a publication day celebration of one of the One Heat Minute Productions family, Jason Bailey. Today, his fantastic new book, Gandolfini, Jim Tony, and the... he's holding it up in the picture. Bless his heart.
I mean,
Jim Tony and the Life of a Legend. He's here to discuss a movie that we missed in 2014 and his amazing book. I can't believe it. Shamefully missed in the Decade Project. Was discussed briefly in a fantastic John Ortiz interview that Katie and I did on Miami Nice. He mentioned that two films were the biggest films that people interrupted him about in the street. One was Miami Vice, and the other, increasingly, was the movie The Drop. So firstly, Jason, great to see you. Congratulations. I can't wait.
Thank you.
Stupid Antipodes. I can't get my hands on a physical copy until like July or some bullshit.
Oh, no.
And I want that physical copy in my hand, so I'll get that eventually. But man, thank you so much for coming to chat on a special edition of the Decade Project for your release.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you think about when it's pub day, I've done a few of these now, and actually you really want distractions. You really want to not just sit there like refreshing, you know, Amazon sales pages or, you know, your social media feeds or whatever. You want shit to do on pub day. So first thing I did this morning, I went to see Sinners, which I missed. The press screenings and opening stuff was all the week when I was promoting the book in Los Angeles. So I didn't get to see it as a critic. And I was like, I haven't had time. I've been so busy getting ready for pub date. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to like go turn my brain over to Ryan Coogler for 2.25 hours. And I'm sure that will help. And it fucking did.
Oh, doesn't it help? Doesn't it help?
And then I was like, and then I'll just chat with Blake for a while. Like, that's a pleasant thing to do and not worry about if anybody's going to buy the book. So thank you for the invite. It timed out nicely.
Yeah, I remember when I did the last episode of One Heat Minute, I dropped it on my son's 6th birthday. My son's first birthday. It was the 6th of July Australian time, and I dropped it, and then I walked away and did family things all day.
Good.
And just basically didn't look at the screen because I was like, it was too much. It was too much.
Yeah.
Too much. You know, it was too many nice things, too many things happening. You're just like, no, I can't. Yep. I'm not gonna doom scroll my life. But look, the film that we're here to talk about, we're going to talk about your fantastic book. Firstly, we'll get to that. But the film that we're here covering is an I don't know exactly when it was released in Australia, so because we get sometimes a squirrely sort of release schedule, but it is
Sure.
Michael R. Roskam's and Dennis Lehane, who wrote
Right.
Animal Rescue, the original short, and was the screenwriter on this thing, wrote The Drop from 2014, which if you've never seen it, you guys can have a listen to the trailer and listen to Tom Hardy. I can't remember who wrote this tweet, but I think about it all the time. It's like, oh, Tom Hardy's doing one of his silly little voices. I'm in. So you're going to hear Tom Hardy's silly little voice, and then we're going to come back and talk about this absolute gem of a little movie.
Hi, gentlemen. These are in the house.
Thank you, Bobby.
Cousin Marv, thanks for the drink, huh?
Thanks a lot, man.
In Brooklyn, money changes hands all night long. And it's not the kind of money that you can deposit in a bank.
You hand over the drop.
But all that money needs to end up somewhere. They call it a drop bar. You just hide the entire city's dirty money right in plain sight.
All your money in the bag.
Do you know what you're doing? Do you know whose money you're jacking?
Fill the bag!
You don't see anything?
Nah, you know, that's this neighborhood, right?
I heard that Cousin Marv doesn't know the bar. Some hard guys do.
You're not a hard guy.
Yeah, we had a crew back in the day when we was young. Marv, he thought he was a tough guy. Then the neighborhood changed. It wasn't enough to be tough no more. You know, you had to be mean.
You know this guy?
No.
Find my money.
Find my money.
You need to see this, Marv.
No, I don't need to see what's in that bag.
No, don't look at that. Don't look at it.
You're still in the life.
Nope.
No, I just tend the bar.
You ever go around the front of the bar and take a look at the names on the sign? Oh, that's my name, because I used to own it once.
They pressed, you blinked, it's over. It's been over for a while now. I'm not this, and I'm not them.
Where is your cousin Marv?
Down. When I walked into a place people set up straight, they noticed I was respected, I was feared. And that meant something.
Are you doing something desperate? Are you doing something that we can't clean up this time? There's some sins that you commit that you can't come back from.
Okay, The Drop, Tom Hardy, but most importantly, James Gandolfini. So
the final film role, the final movie he shot, the final film of his that was released. This came out in the U.S. in the fall of 2014, more than a year after he passed, actually.
Oh wow!
I think he had shot it in the spring of 2013. He passed in June of 2013.
Yeah.
And I think they sort of, I don't know. I think they were holding it for the fall, like as a prestige movie. It premiered at that year's Toronto. It doesn't feel like something they would have had awards hopes for, but maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it had been like a minute since he had gone. And since we had sort of mourned him, and then suddenly we had this, you know, the other posthumous release was Enough Said. That came out in September of 2013, so it still kind of felt like we were in collective shock, mourning, etc. And then here came this lovely little extremely counter type movie in that sort of immediate aftermath, but then this is like a full year later.
Yeah, I remember Enough Said, which is already a beautiful and adorable, cute movie, mm-hmm. basically leveled an audience of culture critics when I was in the screening, because we were all very raw from his passing and watched it. And we're also heartwarmed by he and Julie Louis-Dreyfus together and this whole relationship. And we're just, it leveled an audience. And so I remember that happening. And then obviously now setting that scene, it's later that we get The Drop. And as I said, when we were talking in the intro, we've mentioned Tom Hardy, we've mentioned James Gandolfini, another big actor in this, super important to all things One Heat Minute Productions. John Ortiz is in this. Also Elizabeth Rodriguez, also star of Miami Vice as well. Noomi Rapace, Matthias Schoenaerts, who my friend Maria cannot pronounce his name, and it gives me much glee hearing her mispronounce it. Me teasing her about it. But he said to me last year when he was on the show that this is the movie that most people come. And so I tweeted the other day, it's certainly not something for me, but it just, keep getting reminded of, like, The Drop is the slept on movie Hall of Fame.
Huge, huge.
And whenever you watch it, you watch this little movie that is directed with such delicacy and such a kind of ambience of dread or of like something bad has happened in every nook and cranny of this thing, and it permeates through the screen.
Yeah.
And also pairing that with a very adorable puppy, and it just does things to you. Yeah. And again, it's obviously not a major performance from Mr. Gandolfini in the grand scheme of his amazing career, but it's just yet another one of these amazing performances that he gave. So do you want to I'd love if you could tell us about when you saw it and what your preliminary thoughts were then and now what it's like after writing about this wonderful man who had such a profound impact on us, what you're feeling about him now watching it again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I saw it at a press screening when it came out. I was writing full time about movies by then. And I remember feeling the way that I felt about it. I really liked it a lot. Mm. I thought it was terrific. But I remember feeling at the time, I even re-looked at the piece that I wrote about it at the time. I felt, and I think time has borne this out, that this is an unfortunate case of a really decent crackerjack little genre movie.
Yes.
With no insults
on that. It's just, God bless, a beautiful
parentheses complimentary. Yes.
Yeah, like, such a huge, like, complimentary thing. Small.
Yeah.
Very, yes. Very, very focused.
It's modest. It's about small timers. It's about grinders. It's an insular world. There are really only like four sort of important characters and a couple of others, and that's it.
Yeah.
This movie felt then and will forevermore, I think, feel like an elegy.
Yeah.
You know, that the fact that this was this magnificent actor who was taken from us too soon's final performance, capital F, capital P.
Yeah.
Sort of leveled it with a significance that it was never intended to have, you know, and if had that not been the case, I weirdly feel like it would have made more of an imprint. It would be a movie we talked about more. Yes. I'm actually surprised and relieved to hear that Ortiz said that, because I feel like this is a movie I never hear anybody talk about.
Yeah.
That I'm constantly recommending to people. In fact, I think on this very day, actually, I have to go look and see if it ran, because it was on my brain. Over the weekend, I got a quick turn assignment from my editor at the Times, who said, hey, will you do one of those, you know, these pieces, you know, hey, did you like Havoc? Here are some other movies you might like. And I wrote that over the weekend, and obviously this movie was on my mind, because one of the five that I recommend is The Drop.
The Drop, yeah.
Because I feel like I love Tom Hardy. I think he's a brilliant actor. I don't think he repeats himself, but these characters are certainly in the same key. You know what I mean? Like this is, you know, he's doing his, you know, introverted American man of few words, morally conflicted guy. And so when I was watching Havoc, I found myself continuing. I kept flashing back to little moments in this performance. So I think it would have a more sort of robust afterlife had it not been weighted down with all of that significance when it came down. I hadn't watched it again until I was researching the book. At which point I was really taken by it, and we'll talk about some of what's great about it. And then, yeah, rewatched it last night, and I'm just like, it's just like, it lives in that space of just like the kind of movies that studios, this is a hobby horse, I'm sorry, but studios used to make movies like this all the time.
All the time.
Year round.
This is why people,
all over the calendar.
This is why people excavate the 90s at the moment, in a lot of ways to the death, as far as like what is continuing to be rewatchable or what people go back to. It's because it's like, even the dumbest action movie or whatever, or some small quaint thing, it just has production value for days. It has a really punchy little story. It has a great ensemble. Yep. It's not trying to be the biggest movie ever. It's not trying to, it doesn't purport to save the entire universe.
Yeah.
It's just a story about a bar in, in a little tiny nook of one of the boroughs of New York City that is now a mob bar.
Yeah.
With interesting characters. That's it. That's enough. It's enough.
But I could have seen this coming out in like 1997 from Warner Brothers, you know, with like fairly substantial stars of the moment in it, you know, who, you know, now the big stars in the studios are doing, you know, these tentpole things. And a movie like this comes out from Fox Searchlight.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is an independent movie from, like, you know, an international director. And it's, you know, and Tom Hardy, Noomi Rapace, Jim, these are all, like, you know, actors of note at the time it came out, but certainly no one who broke the bank when they were putting this budget together. But it's just compelling, intelligent, sensitive. I really, every time I see this movie, I am more moved by the way that it concludes.
Yeah.
I am more emotionally involved in that last scene. And what's happening in his eyes in that last shot. Like, it's just very good. It's just a terrific little genre movie. It just is. And we keep saying little, and like, I have little in my notes. You said little before. Like, again, that is not a slant or a slam of any type.
No.
It is a modest programmer, and there should be more of those.
Yeah. And especially at the caliber of all of the people in the movie who retrospectively were big or right at, on exactly the right time. And I remember seeing it at an Australian press screening at the time. I was definitely with my best friend, Maria Lewis, together we saw it, and we were like levitating. Like, that is exactly the kind of movie that I go to the movies for. It was perfect counter programming to a big 2014 at the time, a bigger movies that were coming out. And I was just like, man, wasn't that great? Just like ticked every conceivable box. And so for many years afterwards, you know, as you do, my son coined the phrase, the aisle, you know, in the carousel of your streamers, the aisle. And in Australia, we have a Disney streamer called Star. I've got to find the drop on physical media. I actually don't own the drop on physical media, which I'm shamed about. But it's like on the disgusting carousel aisle that I was going through, I found that it was on our Disney, which is now Fox stuff, our Hulu, our Star.
Sure.
And I just was like, oh, shit. As soon as I found it on that streamer, I'm like, there have been so many times I'm like, what garbage is on? Oh, no, I'm just going to watch The Drop again. And I've just put it on many times. And it's been never once disappointed, just been totally enthralled. I'm like, I'm just going to snuggle up in this movie in what it is for the next hour or so and watch it. So that entire time that's happened, and just even sort of being like kind of cute and facetious the other day, saying it's in the Slept On Movie Hall of Fame, like, that hasn't stopped. People haven't stopped engaging with that thing. Like, it's up to 17,000 views. People keep tagging me and going, oh my God, I'm so glad you mentioned this movie. I love this movie. Thanks for reminding me. I'm going to watch it tonight. Oh my God, I haven't seen that in ages. And then other people mentioning like articles that they'd written and mentioned that in like the Hardy, what they called the Hardy Hall of Fame. And so I feel like it's just kind of, it's this little thing that's come out, this little thing that came out and just sort of escaped a lot of attention. And it just lives there still. And when it's just ready to be surprise you, I think at every turn. It's not like one of the last movies we discussed for one of my shows, which is Nothing But Trouble, when you're working on your Aykroyd. You've gone through like the Dan Aykroyd career and you're like, Blake, this was one of the things that I got in there and I was like watching some of these bad movies. This is like a nice one, I guess, as you're going through someone's amazing, amazing career.
Yeah.
So in the nicest and most concise way I can say, so tell me about Jim. And this movie and this movie's final place in your research, because you are nothing but the most voracious film historian that I know, voracious researching film historian that I know. So going through and charting this career and arriving at this point in his chronology, what was that like for you? Because I imagine for more than anyone now, this had to be an elegy. And I'd love to ask you a couple of weird like IMDb people tagging me saying they had to rewrite the movie because of Jim's passing and things like that. So I'd love to sort of myth bust some of that if that's possible, but just tell me about Jim first.
Yeah. I didn't hear about any of that. As far as I know, it was shot, it was in the can. He had completed his work on the movie. You know, it holds a tricky place because, and this is a running theme throughout sort of the back half of the book, is that Tony Soprano was the character that made him a star. Tony Soprano was the character that gave him, you know, free reign to have the kind of career he wanted to have after that, during that show on the side in its hiatuses and after that show ended. And also it was like a straitjacket that he had to continually like throw himself around rooms to get himself out of that. He had sworn off, if you want to know how far back this tension goes, he had sworn off playing gangsters before The Sopranos.
Yeah.
Like his team, his managers had to talk him into auditioning and then accepting the role in The Sopranos because he was so tired of playing gangsters and thugs and characters that he did not feel his Italian American parents could be proud of.
Yeah.
So from the time he starts working outside of the show, after the show takes off, every role, you look at every single role, you can place it in conversation with Tony Soprano.
Yes.
And try to understand what he's either like. Every role that he took was either subverting the Tony Soprano image of the criminal and power and masculinity and so forth, or was attempting to go completely against type and play something that was 180 degrees from Tony Soprano.
Yeah.
And then there was sort of a less finite, but definitely present third lane of sort of like working class guys that maybe had a little bit of that flavor, but were not criminals. We're of different worlds. So things like The Man Who Wasn't There or Not Fade Away, stuff like that. But really, you know, what you're talking about in the first category are things like The Mexican, where he's playing a character who, like, for the first 30 minutes of the movie, you think, why is he just doing Tony Soprano? And then it turns out that he is an out and proud gay man who just looks and talks and is a contract killer like Tony Soprano. Or something like Killing Them Softly, which was
where he's a hitman who is stuck in a hotel room.
Yeah.
With a chorus line of prostitutes and never exiting a bathrobe and just yelling at Brad Pitt, which is magnificent. Is a magnificent performance.
The idea of Tony Soprano by way of Willie Loman.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that he's like the most deglamorized end of the rope pathetic iteration of the tough crime character that he is so well known for. And, you know, he realized that he could not shake Tony Soprano, and he was always going to look the way that he did, and he was always going to carry the baggage of that role. People were going to think of him when he played them. So that if he was going to take those roles, because as in this movie, as in Killing Them Softly, the writing is so good, it's people he wants to work with, other actors he enjoys. Like in this case, for example, like he specifically said in an interview when he was in production, he said, "I did this movie because I wanted to work with Tom Hardy. I think this guy's a really exciting young actor."
Yeah.
In any of those cases, then it became a matter of, okay, what do I do to, if not outright subvert the Tony Soprano of it all, but to tweak the image, to tweak the appearance, to come at it from a different direction so that I'm not repeating myself, which he had no intention of doing. And so I think the way that manifests itself here, you know, it's not as sharp an incongruity as Mickey in Killing Them Softly, but he is playing, as opposed to Tony Soprano, who rules the world, who is like the man in charge of his corner of that mob and then ultimately of the entire family. This is a guy who, like, the parade has gone by. You know, this is a small timer who no longer even owns the bar that has his name. Like, you know, the idea of a guy who wanted that kind of power, who wanted that kind of importance, and lost it. And so I think that first of all, that it manifests itself in some really interesting physical ways. He always liked to start with the externals and work his way in.
Yeah.
It was very much about, you know, what he's doing with his hair or lack of it, what he's doing with facial hair, what he's doing with clothing. So for this, like the thing that jumped out at me when I came to this in the rewatch for the book was those glasses.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like the entire character is in those glasses. Like, these are not like a sharp young guy's glasses. These are a middle-aged man's glasses.
Yeah.
These are like the glasses of a man who has kind of given up. And
I love that you said that, because that the glasses for me, and it's just, and it's the prominence, and we can both share this with him as our comparing ages, is the prominence of the grays in his beard and the glasses. It's almost like there's a couple of times that the light in the room that he's in is reflecting from the glasses, and it's like white, and there's this white hairs bristling from his sort of goatee and wraparound beard.
From this messy goatee. Messy goatee. And the temples
sharp.
Too.
Yeah, it's not sharp. It's not sharp. It's just the gray coming through. And you're so right. He's like, I would almost call his entire existence, he's become like the flats in a theater play. You know, he's just a painting of an idealized version of this character behind an entire organization, a much bigger crime organization, just continues to run and operate. And it's like, no, you just stand there and distract people and be there and do exactly what we say. And that's it. And, and the deeper you dig past the flat and you see this void that he's carrying and this kind of emptiness of decay and these other things that have been exploited and all those other things that are happening with him and this massive class disparity that's happening in this particular region, all those beautiful things that this movie kind of very subtly is just like giving you that permeation. He's kind of that guy that, and can't wait to get my hands on the physical copy of your book to dig more into all of your research about it. But it's just like that guy, he's just effortless. He's just one of those guys who just in every movie he's in or every scene that he's in The Sopranos, he's doing something, he's making choices that feel effortless.
Yeah.
And you know there's a hell of a lot of effort that goes into them, but he just makes everything look easy.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tantan Dip products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
A 100%. Yeah, that was the dichotomy. Was he was like, he was a Meisner trained actor. He did all of this scene study, character bio, all of this stuff. He actually, to go back to the glasses just for a second, like I interviewed Susan Astin, was one of the first people I interviewed, and she was his. They started out as struggling young actors in New York in the late 80s. They did off Broadway plays together. they did character research together. They did a lot of work together. And then after he started getting in movies, he would come to her for advice on characterization, the kind of, you know, one-on-one attention that you couldn't get as just like a day player or a supporting role in a big movie. And then she ended up coming on to The Sopranos. She's credited all throughout all the seasons of The Sopranos as his dialogue coach.
Yeah.
But basically, she was his one-on-one acting coach for that show and for all of the films he made during and after, up to and including this one. So we talked about this movie, and I asked her about the glasses because that just like so clear to me that. And she said, "This is the quote I'm reading from the book. Those were not slept on. Those were well thought out. We looked at a lot of glasses. I don't remember who was bringing them over to the apartment, but somebody was bringing over different things for us to look at. It was not the production that supplied them." So like he like found like a glasses guy who he had bring over like dozens of glasses to try on and to, you know, to so that he could get exactly the right ones for playing this guy. So like the glasses are very specific. The tracksuit is really specific.
Yeah.
Again, Tony Soprano wore tracksuits, but not this kind of a tracksuit. It's just, it's not quite as sharp. It's like a 4-year-old tracksuit. You know what I mean?
I was just going to say, it's like being both dads, you put your kids, and sometimes now as a dad, you're just in, like, if it's cold, if it's wet, if it's rainy, a dreary day, you leave the house and you're all in like kind of very modest, shapeless tracksuits. And then you see, like, you go out into the world, you dart down to your local supermarket to pick up some food or whatever. And then there's, I feel like it's like an active wear kind of post JLo, very tight fitting, very manicured tracksuit you see on people. And you're like, I would have just preferred to wear like nice jeans if I was dressing up. A tracksuit is the daggiest. That's an Australian word. It's the daggiest thing I can wear. It's just like, I'm this is a pure comfort thing. It's cold. Throw the kids in there.
And that's what he's got a person who is like shapeless, comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's bitterly cold.
Tracksuit. Leather jacket. Pageboy cap. Yep. That's like, these are all such specific choices that tell us immediately who this guy is and that he is not Tony Soprano.
Yes.
And like, that was just of such paramount importance. And then even the voice, that it's like, it's not quite the Tony voice. Yep. And this is one of the things that I really like paid very close attention to in watching all of the work chronologically, was the degree to which he used variations of or eschewed entirely the Tony voice, which was not his speaking voice.
Yes.
He had shed, if he ever had that thick of a regional dialect, he had shed it by then. His actual speaking voice is something is kind of close to like to what he's doing in Enough Said.
Enough Said reminds me of interviews I've watched with him.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Prior
Enough
to his
Said, or even The Last Castle, where it almost kind of had a nasal quality to it. So he's it's not quite the Tony Soprano voice. It's a little more guttural. And in doing that, in making that choice, I feel like it gives it more of a Brooklyn flavor.
Yes.
Like the sort of that it's grinding in the throat a little more makes it sound more like Brooklyn than Jersey in an interesting way. So these are all like very specific choices that he's making. Number one, to create a specific character, which is always first and foremost, but number two, to make it, to telegraph to the audience, hey, I know you know me as Tony Soprano, this guy is not that guy, you know, which is important.
He's very sweet, and it's so funny if you've, and I've only done this a couple of times, like a Sopranos rewatch intersected with a revisit of The Drop in the last 10, 11 years. Finished that, and then coming into this, and he has, you know, people have been talking about, like, I don't know, the meme of like, this is what aura is, like, you know, recently has been popping up. So I'll use that in the parlance of this, which is the aura on this man just in general. But the aura in The Sopranos is unparalleled. He walks into the room. He's a bigger guy, but he fills the space. But he feel like he casts this like rippling of people always having to have all of their faculties to deal with him. And what's so nice in The Drop is that he can go unnoticed. Even in the very first scene of the movie where Bob's behind the bar toasting a departed local character with the, you know, with his friends who are celebrating his passing, having a shot, watching the Monday Night Football. And then he just appears like he lives in the furniture. Like he's there and people are
ignoring him. Just been off to the side that whole time. Yeah.
And people are ignoring him. And I'm like, that's a chasm. Because if you've been watching The Sopranos, you can't miss Tony. You can't miss him.
Yeah.
And no one can miss him.
And then to that end, I'm so glad you brought that up. Then what's really fascinating, also in contrast to the sort of the power that he always holds in any scene in The Sopranos, just about, when you put that up against how, you know, watching him in a subservient low power position with the Chechen mob guys, you know, like when they turn up I was shoveling, you know, like that whole little sequence.
Sure you were. And he's like, you're just making
they're
Bob
like,
do it? And
they're totally,
like, they're like defending Bob from him. It's such a weird, fun
they're
little
totally play. Punking him in that scene. Like, they are busting his balls, and he's like, he's embarrassed by it. And it's like, that's a note we're not used to seeing him play. Right there.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I mean. It's like, in so many of these spaces and in the different arcs that happened in The Sopranos, as their family consolidates power and things like that, there are definitely people who radically underestimate or want to play this kind of more dismissive. You just do your little thing with your little family in Jersey and just get out of our face. And there's so many times where that becomes like a serve, and the volley that's waiting for them, you just feel it. It's just like, oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Here comes Agassi. Mm-hmm. Here comes Agassi. He's just about to just absolutely come back. And whether it's like they're going to get it right in that moment or they're going to get it soon, it's like it's about to happen. Whereas in this, he feels so like, you know, he's but every time he wants to bust Bob's balls in this, Tom Hardy's wonderful, like little quaint character. Yeah. Every time he busts his balls, someone defends Bob. Like a Chechen mob guy is like, yeah, leave Bob alone. He's all right. He's fine. He's fine. Bob, was this the guy? Like, I don't know. Like every moment that happens, it's like he's trying to exert power and he's like undercut. He's like, oh yeah, sure. You were shoveling. Oh yeah. Poor Bob. Don't pick on Bob. Bob's this, Bob's that. So we'll get around to the other great performances in this movie, but it's a delight. And so, yeah, just back to something I mentioned, because someone was like, oh, I think the ending of this movie was reshot. So I went on a deep dive and I did back then. I remember doing it. This wasn't reshot. Like it wasn't from anything that I could find. It's a perfect ending. And I'm like, it doesn't feel like in the scope of the story. I was even trying to find the original script online. It's like, it doesn't say in the scope of the story that the character that he's playing, Cousin Marv, is doing anything except exactly what is happening. He's waiting outside of the bar for Eric Dietz, Matthias Schoenaerts. He's waiting out there for him to do this thing in the car. He sees that guy who asks him for directions, and there's that beautiful little twinkle that happens, and he's waiting. And then what happens to conclude the movie. And I'm like, no, it's the natural order. Someone is deviating from this plan and interrupting this Chechen mob process. And what happens? They get disappeared.
Right. Now, what I will say is what I did read, and I don't know if maybe this sort of got telephoned into the thing that you're talking about, is once they signed Gandolfini to do the film, Lehane wrote a few more scenes or wrote him into a few more scenes solely because they wanted him in the movie more. They wanted, you know, once they saw what he was doing with the character and how great he and Hardy were together, they just wanted more of that. So they did rewrite the script slightly during production to give him a little more to do. But no, I mean, I can't even imagine, like, if you were going to rewrite the ending, you would, I guess, rewrite it to where he doesn't die, so everybody's not depressed at the end of the movie because James Gandolfini's dead too. Like, I don't follow the logic of that.
No, I couldn't follow the breadcrumbs of the logic. And I also, speaking to like a scene of the way that it pops up, it's like that wonderful scene with he and Anne Dowd.
Yeah.
I forgot how much I love that scene of like, and I've been recently, I'm not sure if you've had a chance amongst your publication, but I'll say if you want a great distraction, watch The Pit.
I've heard.
Because of much like ER, the stories of an ER are like people's lives and people struggling with people at their worst moments, whether it's an elder parent who's going to pass away or whatever, or if it's, you know, tragedy has befallen people. But one of the storylines in The Pit is about a brother and a sister whose father is in an elder care facility and he's coming to the end of his life.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I was, and in the last couple of, it's only very recently, my wife and I, it's like, we found our new show. I'm like, yo, I'm super late to The Pit party. Much love to all of you guys who've been telling me to watch it. I finally watched it. But I was watching The Drop in order to chat to you again to remind myself how much I love this movie. And there's this, that beautiful scene of them just talking about the struggles of a parent who is being survived by machinery at this point and just paying for this care, and Anne Dowd's Dottie being more comfortable. Like, should we let him go? Like, you know, should we keep doing this? Is this a life? And him having that burden of like, no, I'm not turning off the machines. I'm not being the person who makes this decision so that we can be more financially secure, because they're obviously struggling at this point, struggling lower working class people, you know? And she's like, well, I guess I'll never see Europe. Or she says this beautiful turn of phrase, like, I guess I'll never see Europe. I guess I'll never see that. And it just made my heart ache, because that's the most real shit. There's so many real things in this movie, but it's the most real shit in a movie like this.
It is. And a thing that I complain about to no end is how bereft we are of honest, unsentimental portrayals of working class people in movies today. That, like, you know, we're either constant, you know, most of the stuff we watch is like, you know, luxury porn.
Yes.
Occasionally we get a little bit of misery porn, And most people, it seems, most characters have, there's no interest whatsoever in how they make a living, whether they're struggling, et cetera, et cetera. But like, this is, that is an entire scene that is arguably, I mean, it's certainly comes into his motivations. Yeah. For what's going on in the main narrative, but it's not like unnecessary. It's not a plot necessary movie. You know what I mean? If you're a strict sort of every scene has to move the plot forward, it does not have to be there. But it's so important in understanding why Marv is doing what he's doing and why their relationship is the way it is. And Jesus Christ, Ann Dowd is so good. Always. This was a year and a half after Compliance, I think.
Yeah.
So like when she first shows up, I sat bold upright. I'm like, oh, there's the Compliance lady. She's great. Yeah. She's always good.
She's always good in like everything. And Ann Dowd usually is like, she's so much more memorable because she's like freaky. And also she's so cute as Dottie. And right around this time is True Detective, another Ann Dowd where you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. You know, please don't make flowers. We don't want to talk about that. But it's so good. This movie also has James Frenchville, who is a fantastic young Australian actor. He plays Fitz. He's the one of the young robbers in the movie. And for international listeners, local listeners too, he's the main kid in Animal Kingdom. So this is just the guy that Marv sort of unwittingly uses as a speed bump in this movie is the star of Animal Kingdom, and obviously not the star because it's Ben Mendelsohn and Joel Edgerton, but he's like the kid,
the central character,
the central character in that movie.
Oh,
and
wow.
he himself, I just want to say, because usually in the Decade Project we talk about what we've learned, but like what we've learned is like he's had a wonderful and weird little career. He's popped up on Peaky Blinders. He's been in, he was in recently The Royal Hotel, which is a really cool little movie. He's in Masters of the Air. He's in The Dry. He's sort of popped up on TV. He's steadily young working actor. And I just remember, you know, greater than a decade ago, seeing Animal Kingdom for the first time and just being absolutely knocked sideways from his performance, particularly in the first couple of minutes of that movie and then going into it. So it was so nice to go back and be reminded that he was here, and just thinking like, what a great young kid. Like, he took an opportunity. It was like, oh, it's what, who's this movie got in it? Oh, you mean James Gandolfini's gonna be in this movie? Like, I would imagine he's like, I'll do anything this movie. I'll just, if I am, am I standing, I don't care if he run me over with a truck, I'll just get to talk in a movie as a character next to James Gandolfini. I'm in. So it's got a great thing. And what I learned talking to the great John Ortiz, who plays Detective Torres, is that he and Elizabeth Rodriguez were in a theater company in New York together. So they were friends. They're actually very close.
Wow.
And they did a couple of these movies kind of, you know, funnily, sequentially. They did, you know, Miami Vice together. And then many years later, they're still in that theater realm.
Yeah.
And they came back together in this, but they'd known each other. And so then you've got, obviously, a couple of other imports with Matthias Schoenaerts and Noomi Rapace at the same time coming in. But you've got these real salt of the earth kind of like New York people in this movie together.
Every time I watch this movie, Matthias blows me away. I am hard pressed to think of a more loathsome character.
Oh.
I mean, like top 10 motherfuckers, like in a movie ever. You just hate him so much. And so it's so satisfying when his story resolves itself. And
we
then,
can say,
and
it's this, now 11 years old. He gets shot in the face, and besides the fact that it's
so
terrible,
satisfying,
you're like, yeah, good. Because especially there's a moment, talk about menacing and loathsome. He sort of bustles his way into Bob's home, his beautiful old home, which is reminding me of my grandmother's home. Speaking of how, you know, knickknacks and old photographs and plastic and those things that are in many of our grandmother's homes or were. And he takes an umbrella, and in a little crate for Rocco the puppy dog, Bob comes back home, and and an umbrella is skewering through the crate. Now, Rocky is uninjured, but the implication of this sort of like threat note with that umbrella is just chilling, like just a chilling, awful guy. And a very satisfying crescendo to the reveal of who Bob really is, paired with his downfall.
But then, and this is the part of it I always forget, the great like minute or so of Tom Hardy just like muttering at him after he's killed him. Just like giving him the fucking business about how you don't dress like that on a date. You come in here and do it. Like, it is so good. It is such a terrific, weird, perfect thing that like just that whole the whole build of what we've just found out about Bob, the thing as the John Ortiz character puts it so well, they never see you coming.
They never see
like
you coming.
The information he's just revealed, the violence he's first said he's capable of and then demonstrated that he's capable of, but then also he has these other issues that he'd like to get off his chest as well. Like
My friend Travis says this great phrase. He's like, with some things, he's like, it's the conversation you have with your steering wheel. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you've left the place that you wish you had to come back, and you're like,
100%.
And so this movie actually centering that, like, I wish I'd said these pithy insults before the gunshot, but it just wasn't going to happen because he's a loathsome, threatening character and I'm not that guy, but I have to get it out to conclude it.
Yes. Yes.
Which makes poor Noomi Rapace's Nadia even more confused. She's just like, not only has he just shot this guy in the head, like he shot him in the neck and then shoots him in the face. He then stands over him and talks to him and then is like, huh? Yeah, you can go see you. Like, it's all good.
Yeah. It's a great scene. It's so, I keep using the same word, but there is no better description than satisfying. Oh. Like, you hate him so much.
Yes.
And nothing bad that could happen to him would be enough.
Yes.
So like that he not only gets shot, but like he humiliates the corpse is like, okay. All right, that's almost enough for what a loathsome sack of shit this guy is.
And that's what really, and what's for the almost the entirety of the movie, you're heartbroken for Marv because he can't catch a break. And Morgan Spector plays Andre, who's the head of this Chechen crime family who's running things, and he's constantly kind of belittled.
Yep.
But when you see Marv's desperation to make this play and to sort of activate this sort of betrayal, him dealing with Eric Deeds, you're like, Marv, no, this guy's the biggest disrespectful piece of shit. Why would you do it? Mm-hmm. And then using him to orchestrate something to get a reaction out of Bob, it's just like, oh God, like Marv didn't see Bob coming. And Marv should have. If there's anyone that should have seen Bob coming, it was Marv. And that's what's ultimately so bad. And you're like, oh God, you kind of, as soon as he even speaks to him, you're like, oh Marv, you are sealing your fate. Like up to that point, we've literally seen a person kept in the back of a truck with a drill bit through their leg. and you've seen all these things and these guys coming in and cleaning up bodies and whatnot. And it's just like, oh God, these guys are as real as it gets.
I love Jim's acting in that scene. That's one of my favorite little scenes. Just like it's not quite the same level of like low power subservience that we're talking about in the scenes with the Chechens, but like the way that he says, no, I'm too old for that shit. I come in peace, you know, is like, That is such a beautiful line reading. It's one of those tiny moments that tells us everything we need to know about that guy.
There's also that you mentioned before about like portrayals of working class people. And one of the things that I love is that like in a lot of cop movies, cop shows, I think the best ones for me recently, I know this sounds like so dumb to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, is like when people talk about budget, they're like,
yeah,
it's when they actually say, we don't have the budget, We don't want to do the overtime. We don't want to have the, it's like, and I think that was one fantastic thing about The Wire. It's like, no, we can't orchestrate an entire, you know, elaborate criminal investigation that requires the amount of police work and intensity that you need to do, unless there's some level of attention that's being cast on it so we can divert the budget and it works that way. Otherwise, people vying for the political attention is not going to happen. So The Wire does so many great things with that. There's that great moment of like, John Ortiz is a detective, sees his friend, played by Elizabeth Rodriguez, Detective Romsey, and he's there. They're there together. They see each other in the street, you know, stop and have a little, turn their coffee into a hot toddy or whatever they're doing. They just have a little sip of something warm in this cold bit of winter in Brooklyn. And when they sit together, it's like, major crimes, you know, our unit's all but disbanded. We're not, there's no task force that's working on these guys. And he has to ask for favors and sort of take crumbs off the table of someone else. And like, that's a little mini negotiation. Read what you're going to read. Give me back this packet so I don't get in trouble. You got like 30 seconds and then I'm leaving because I've got things to do, right? Because every minute of my day is being monitored by someone who wants efficiency. And I think we've kind of moved into that now in our present moment of like, there used to be that phrase of like efficiency, which meant automation, which meant less people, which meant like, you know, taking away physical tactile things like, you know, filling letters or whatever became email. Everything's faster. Do everything on your phone. The transformational aspects of technology. But now it's all about like that efficiency has been beautifully spun into like you become the commander of a digital army of AI that can help you do your job and a million other things better. And it's like, I can use it. It makes it so much easier for me and makes, you know, blah, 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 less time. I've got more time to do other things. And it's almost like they've turned you into the boss. Like before it was, this was something that was being done to you. And that's what this movie displays. And now it's so interesting after 10 years to come back to be like, oh no, you're the architect of like your own world efficiency. It's like, actually, am I? Or am I using something that's ultimately going to make me redundant in every available capacity that I have?
Or something that's so accident and error prone that I end up doing my previous job and like three other jobs that you eliminated and replaced with this fucking thing.
Yes, exactly.
That too.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's just very interesting. A very interesting sort of dichotomy. But seeing those guys here and seeing cops just like, you got one cop and it's like, we can't find a body. There's no witnesses. No one's talking. Okay, well, I guess it's a cold case. And it's just like they put it in a drawer. There's not like some, like every piece of pulp drama there is out, the cop drama out there of like a cold case unit who's there to discover these huge criminal conspiracies. No.
Yeah.
Someone got disappeared. No one's complaining about it. Yes. No one's talking. So put it in a drawer. Shut up. Move on.
Correct.
We've got other things to do.
Yes. One moment that I love so much in this, like a moment between Hardy and Gandolfini, where they're both doing some terrific low key acting, is the scene where they where Bob finds the bag, and opens it up, and he and like and this is also smart direction, how. When are we gonna see what's in the bag? Bob sees it. Bob is clearly distressed by it. Marv doesn't want to see it, and I love what he's doing in that scene where he's like, you need to see this, Marv. No, I don't need to do anything. I just need to stand right here, right the fuck here. Like, I love that complete disengagement from whatever bad thing has reared its ugly head. Like, I'd rather not know.
I'd rather not know. And also, just across the bar, you see Bob, beautifully, such a fastidious cleaner that he is in this movie, just like pulling absolutely blood-soaked money out to wash it painfully every individual night. And you're like, there's a body part in there, and it's surrounded by money. I don't want to know what's there. But Bob just, we should.
When he's
should,
wrapping it in the Saran wrap. I shouldn't laugh. It's grim, but when he points that out to him, like how meticulously he's doing, it's great. These are the little human moments that always make crime movies interesting and special. When like, you know, I'm never going to, I hope, need to wrap a severed body part. But if I do, that's probably how I'll do it. Yep. Like when I'm wrapping up leftovers after dinner.
I was just going to say, we've all wrapped up a leftovers. We've all had to, you know, cut down, you know, you buy a big piece of steak and you got to cut it down into some like family size portions. It's like, yeah, you do that. You do, you use your glad wrap, your cling wrap in that way.
Yeah.
And also just, I love that. There's such like a deeply, relatably ethnic thing of like scrubbing floors, scrubbing old carpet to make it shine again. And he's got all those beautiful things, Bob. It's a beautiful, it's a bunch of really phenomenal people, including the great James Gandolfini, in this movie, just really relishing a beautifully poetic and loaded script and acting the living bejesus out of it. And it's entirely rewarding every time. And it just is, it's a little lost, beautiful little lost artifact. And I'm so glad we found the opportunity to talk about it. Congratulations on publication day.
Thank you so much. I can't wait
to physically hold this book and voraciously consume it and then immediately watch the entire series of The Sopranos again and watch The Last Castle again. I've watched it a couple of years ago. I really enjoyed it when I watched it again.
Yeah, I did. There is one little story from the book about this movie I want to tell before we close it out.
Please, close the show with this.
I love this. Okay, here we go. They're in production. And so they're shooting at a bar in Brooklyn in Sheepheads Bay that had closed. So they're shooting at this shutdown bar. During one of the shooting days at Holstrom's bar, Gandolfini was treated to a surprise visitor. And here's the quote from Tony Sirico. Paulie Walnuts says, "I pranced in the saloon door in the middle of a rolling scene. Jimmy had no idea I was coming. I slammed my palm on the bar and said, 'Whoa, what do I got to do to get a drink around here?' Everybody was stunned. When Jimmy saw me, he broke up laughing and hugged me like a big teddy bear." And in retrospect, with the time frame, and you know, he was mostly living in LA at that point. That may have been the last time he and Tony Sirico saw each other. But I love that they got to have that moment on this set. That he got to surprise him like that. It's a beautiful memory, I think.
Well, director Michael Roskam would have loved orchestrating that because whoever was in that bar, including Tom Hardy, would have lost their mind. Like a Brooklyn community scene. Paulie Walnuts walk in and go, "Oh,
yeah,
what I got to do to get a trick?" People just like, everyone stops, all the grips drop the shit. It just, it's a party. It's a party. Paulie Walnuts is here, guys. It's a party. Thank you for that beautiful story. Thank you for your dedication. And on this great man and this great artist of our time. And thank you so much for talking to me about this great, very little movie that can escape you, but do everything in your power not to let it escape you. It's such a beautiful movie. Go watch it. The Drop is fantastic. Jason Bailey, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.